Hey, everybody, it's Kyle with this week's episode of the Corner Office Podcast. Before we get to it, though, please do just confirm for us that you are, in fact, subscribed to this podcast, because that helps in the numbers, honestly. And if you're a regular listener, please leave us a review in iTunes. Let us know what you think. All right, so this week, my guest is Stephanie Meek. She is the CEO of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, also the author of a book called The Past and Future City, How Historic Preservation is Reviving America's Communities. I went out to her offices in Washington, D.C. for this one. Here you go.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Stephanie Meeks, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Tell me what this organization does, because I bet lots of people have lots of different ideas.
We work across the country to save important cultural and historic places that represent our country's history. And we believe by doing that, that we're helping to ensure a more vibrant future.
Who gets to decide what those places are?
Well, we work with communities to decide what's important to them and try to empower them to save the places that are important.
Is it this is going to sound pejorative, is it like bureaucracy getting authorized to save these buildings, I guess?
There are different levels of protection. And it's true that to reach the highest levels of protection in this country, to be on the National Register of Historic Places or a National Historic Landmark, mm-hmm. there are a number of steps to go through. But local communities also decide what's important to them, and they can show that in a number of different ways, either through some kind of historic designation or simply by deciding to continue to use a place by not tearing it down, investing in it for the future.
So not tearing it down is a plus then, right? And that's a catch, because a lot of times people see economic benefit in tearing something down and building something new.
Yeah, well, we beg to differ here at the National Trust. We want to be on the side of solutions. And so we work with cities and developers across the country to figure out how to use historic places in a way that helps move cities forward. We've done a lot of research here, Kai, that shows that historic buildings are really great economic incubators in cities.
Well, play that out a little bit, right? Because I'm going to poke you in the eye and offer you this thought. I'm a history guy, right? And everybody who listens to this program knows that. But make the case to local communities that, if you can, that it's better to save an old building for its economic benefit than build, say, a shopping mall or a retail center or something else.
Well, what our research has shown over time is that historic buildings really are economic incubators. There's a famous urban activist named Jane Jacobs who mm-hmm. wrote in the 1960s.
In New York City, sure.
The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And one of the statements that she makes in her book is that cities need old buildings so badly, it's impossible for vibrant districts to grow without them. And we set out to determine whether or not that's true by mapping historic buildings and new buildings, all the buildings in 50 cities, and seeing how different blocks performed on a number of different criteria. And what we found in all 50 cities that we've looked at so far is that blocks that have a mix of old and new buildings have more small businesses. They have more women and minority-owned businesses. They're denser. And they have more affordable housing units on average. So these historic buildings really are playing a very unique and important role in our cities today.
How do you decide what to save and what not to save? Because you can't save everything, and not everything is worth saving, right?
Yeah, it's true. We can't save everything. And we really try to empower communities to decide what's important to them, and even individuals to decide what's important to them. We know that everybody has a place that they care about. And we want people to connect to that place and to think about what this world would be like without the place they care about, and to blow that up and think about the places that matter to us as a country, and to join with us and other preservation organizations around the country in saving those places that are important to our American story.
Not everything should be saved, right? That's a tricky question to ask the head of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But right? I mean, because you can't.
It's not possible to save everything. I think that's true. But we want people to be mindful about what we're choosing to save and what we're choosing to let go.
So what do you...
and I'm talking you sort of in the royal you here as the head of this organization, what do you guys look for? What do you think about when you put that list together of, yeah, I should save this one, probably not that one?
Well, because we're a national organization, we focus our energy on places that are nationally significant and that are facing some kind of threat. So we are looking for those opportunities. We also, Kai, want to make sure that the work that we do represents the full breadth of the American story. When people look at our website or look at the work of the National Trust, I want them to see the history of their people represented here. One of the things that I learned when I took this job 7 years ago is that of the places that are formally designated as historic in this country, fewer than 10% of them represent the history of women or people of color. Now, we know that women are already the majority in this country, We know that people of color will soon be the majority in this country. So as we decide what we're working on at the National Trust, we've been very intent on making sure that we're looking for those places that really represent the full American story.
Yeah, so it's a question really of whose history you're saving, but more to the point, and to get to a word that's sort of a loaded phrase here, right? There's gentrification written all over a lot of what's in this book and a lot of what you guys do, which is a not uncontroversial topic.
Well, that's right. I mean, first on whose history are we saving? One of the important things to realize, I think, is that there are layers of history all over the United States. And we need to make sure we're not just telling the most superficial layer, but that we're looking at the full story of what's transpired in a certain place. But on the issue of gentrification, I think too often preservation and gentrification are just lumped together. I travel all over the country, Kai, and what I see time and again, cities and towns that are making a very deliberate decision to improve neighborhoods without displacing the people who have lived there for decades.
Yeah, but that's so hard. You know?
It is hard, but it can be done. And there are great examples all over the country.
Well, give me your favorite.
Well, I'll talk about one in Atlanta's Old Fourth Ward. Okay. It's an area called Sweet Auburn. This is where Martin Luther King grew up. And back in the 1950s, it was known as the richest Negro street in the world. It was a very vibrant neighborhood and commercial district. And it fell on hard times over the years. There's a group down there called the Historic District Development Corporation that's been working to improve the Sweet Auburn District and to bring it back. And they've done a fantastic job. They've rehabbed 110 single-family homes. They've done very sensitive infill development, 500 multifamily housing units, 40,000 square feet of commercial space. And they've done that without displacing any of the existing residents because that was one of their intentions when they started this work. So it can be done, and it can be done in very complex and challenging environments.
If I say the phrase real estate developer to you, is that sort of a dirty word?
Not at all. We work with real estate developers. We have a number of real estate developers on our board of trustees.
Better inside the tent than out?
We find that real estate developers are obviously very important decision makers about the shape of our cities, what gets saved and what gets torn down. The book that I wrote was written to try to reach mayors, council members, and developers, the people who are really shaping the landscape of our American cities, and to make the case to them that saving their historic buildings is a great way of building the 21st century cities that we're all interested in living in.
Given that you're as you said, you're working at the national level, right? Is there a difference in historic preservation between small towns and big cities? Do you approach it that way? Do folks in this field approach it differently?
I don't think so. No, I think that the challenges are very much the same, both in small towns and big cities. What we find is that when the leadership of a city understands the benefits of historic buildings, they're committed to bringing forward their history as part of their future, that it's much easier to get preservation done. And when you have leaders who have not yet fully understand the benefits of preservation, it's a real challenge, whether it's a small city or a small town or a big city.
So let me pick up on something you just said. How do you make political leaders understand
the benefits of historic preservation, right? Because they've got this mandate of, I got to grow the economy, I got to have more jobs, I want real estate developers to be happy, I want to get a property tax base. And, you know, you keep the old buildings hanging around and that's not going to happen.
Well, I beg to differ.
our research
shows that that just isn't the case. We've done this mapping project in 50 cities across the United States. It's a project that we call the Atlas of Reurbanism, which shows on a block-by-block basis how existing historic buildings are performing against existing new buildings in these cities. And it tells a very compelling story. These blocks with a mix of old and new buildings have more small business jobs. They have more minority and women-owned businesses. They have more diversity in housing costs, meaning more opportunity for people along the economic spectrum. So we're hoping that our research and getting the word out about that will help people see the historic buildings the same way we see them.
Yeah. Are you, just to get it to current events a little bit, as a woman running a civic institution in a time of declining government funding and other stressors on your environment, what's your stress level running this organization right now?
I'd say that running a nonprofit organization is never an easy enterprise. We raise 50% of our money every year from private contributions. Hmm. We don't receive government funding, so that's not a particular area of concern for us in this current environment.
Really? Come on. Really?
Well, from a funding perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But on the bigger question of your role in this civic society today.
We see a tremendous opportunity, actually, for preservation. There's sort of this groundswell as the two largest demographic generations in American history are moving back to cities, the millennials and baby boomers who are becoming empty nesters. And they're driving this resurgence of cities. Our cities, more of us in the United States are living in cities today than ever before in American history. And one of the things we know about both of those groups is that they love historic buildings. Hmm. So we see this current moment in time as being an amazing opportunity for what we do as an organization.
So you look at what's happening, just for instance, in Detroit, right, which is a city that has had no small share of problems. But you do see into that core, you see artists and young people moving back in. And you think that's a net plus for you?
It's absolutely a net plus, and we see business owners making big investments in these places as well. Number of high tech firms moving into historic buildings, both on the West Coast, but increasingly in the inner parts of the United States, because those are the kinds of spaces that their employees want to work in.
How do you get those millennials though, who are making those moves, to be your constituents, right? Because you think, and this is going to sound more pejorative than I mean it to, but you think the National Trust for Historic Preservation and you think old and fusty, right? Right? But what you need now is you need the younger people who are moving to these cities to become interested in what it is that you do.
Well, you're right. I think a lot of people have a specific image in mind when they think historic preservation. And we're trying to change that image by embracing projects that you might not associate with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And I'll give you one example.
Sure.
The Houston Astrodome.
Oh, yeah.
Where the National Trust has been engaged with Harris County and a number of local organizations for a number of years to figure out, first, how to save the Houston Astrodome, but now what to do with it, and how to repurpose that building so that it's a very vibrant and contributing structure to Houston and Harris County in the 21st century.
Listeners in Houston will not appreciate this, but there's a case to be made that building ought to just be blown up just because it's old and gross and, you know, big and taking up space and all of that.
It's not old or gross. It's a fantastic building. It was the first domed stadium of its kind, and it was a precursor of so many stadiums that came after it. And we believe that it has a future in Houston and can play a very distinctive
role. So are you going to make it a shopping mall? What are you going to do?
No, we're going to make it,
The plan.
What we're hoping that Harris County will consider over time is making it a very vibrant space for all kinds of different community gatherings.
Huh. They're going to have to be pretty big gatherings. It's a big building.
It's sort of an indoor park, like a Highline in the round, if you will.
Highline, the thing in Manhattan, of course.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. What do you do all day? Seriously. I mean, as you run this historic preservation organization, what do you do? How do you do it?
Well, we are working with colleagues across the country on a variety of different preservation projects. It makes my job very interesting because no two projects are the same and no 2 days are the same.
Yeah.
You know, as the CEO of a nonprofit organization, I spend a lot of time raising money and giving talks, trying to raise the visibility of the organization and invite more people to join us in our common cause.
Do you have architectural historians and that's the like on the staff here, or do you depend on the people who come to you for help to have done their own homework, I guess?
We have some of both. And we have a lot of liberal arts majors working for the National Trust, people who have art history degrees and history degrees and English majors. We do have an architect on staff and a number of specific skills that you would expect for an preservation organization.
Talk to me about rural preservation for a minute, because even though, as you said, people are moving to the cities more than they ever have, really, there's a lot of preservation that has to happen not in the cities. Is that different than doing it in an urban environment?
You know, when I think of rural America, I think of our main streets and the role that historic main streets have and continue to play. As you point out, Kai, people are, you know, demographically we're seeing this shift to cities, but there are a lot of people still living in the middle of the country and in smaller towns. They care about their historic buildings as much as anybody, and we find very vibrant preservation advocacy happening in those places.
I want to get back to the idea of gentrification for a second, because that's obviously a big part of what's in this book and how you deal with it and what's out there. When you take these neighborhoods, which are sometimes old and in disrepair, and you try to save them and make them economically useful for today, a lot of people get squeezed out. How hard is it to let those folks still have a home, but work toward economic progress in those areas?
It's hard, but not impossible. And we do see examples across the country of cities that are managing that balance very well. The research is interesting on this topic. We have seen statistics that show that if you're a home owner, you're no more likely to leave a gentrifying neighborhood than you would leave a neighborhood at any time. And if you do leave, it's to take advantage of the rising tide, just like anybody might take advantage of the fact that their home value has increased. The people that we have to watch out for in gentrifying neighborhoods are the people that are renters. And small business owners who are renting, because those are the people who are most at risk. And there are ways that cities can help address that through rent control, through heritage business laws, ways that they can look out for the community members who have lived there for decades, who have created those communities, and who will ensure that we continue to create communities and environments that work for everybody and not just for a few.
It's tricky, right? Because you want to look out for those people, but you also want to make way and make room for economic development and literally for property development too.
Right. But we think that those two things can go hand in hand. And I'll give you an example. We're doing some work in the city of Louisville, Kentucky right now that has mapped the number of surface parking lots and vacant lots that they have in the city. And there's enormous opportunity for a city like Louisville, and I'd say this is true of most of our cities, to do sensitive infill development in places that are where there are no buildings right now. So you don't have to displace people. You can create density and create new commercial space and new residential space while maintaining the historic fabric and the communities that have been there for a long time.
So the question actually goes like this. This is a country which has traditionally not spent a whole lot of time looking back, and it's always forward and new and better and bigger and more, and I want.
on your best days, are you making progress in that, or is it two steps forward, one step back? Which I guess is progress too, but you know what I mean.
I think we're making a lot of progress, actually. And I'll tell you, in just in the 7 years that I've been in this job, 7 years ago, we were out making the case that preservation is good business. And crickets, you know, not getting a very strong response to that. Today, we're working arm in arm with the Urban Land Institute, with mayors, with developers across the country who see the same market forces that we see. And that is that as millennials and empty nesters move back into cities, they're flocking to neighborhoods with historic buildings. People want more authenticity in their lives, in what they wear, in what they eat, and in the kind of places they live. And that's the kind of authenticity that historic buildings can bring to a city.
Which I totally get. But those millennials and the empty nesters, they want the cool old buildings with exposed brick and neatly redone beams, but up-to-date appliances and all of that stuff. And none of that is cheap, and a lot of urban renters can't get there from here. How do you take care of those folks?
Well, again, there are cities who are figuring out a way to do this. And I think that there are numerous opportunities to help people through rent control, through property tax freezes. There's a great story in Macon, Georgia. The Historic Macon Foundation, one of our partner organizations, has been working for a number of years to reinvest in a neighborhood called the Bells Hill neighborhood, and it's right next to Mercer University. Mm-hmm. Over the course of several years, they've invested in improving 500 homes, and they've done it without displacing any of the current residents. At the same time, the property taxes in the area have increased by $1 million a year, and they've done that by building on vacant lots. But they've also worked with the city to apply property tax freezes for some low-income homeowners. And they've also recruited low-income homeowners into the area to ensure that the neighborhood continues to have that balance that everybody wanted to see.
Seems to me you can't do it by yourself, right? It can't just be a nonprofit thing. You have to get that, and this is a trite old phrase, you have to get that public-private partnership, right? Because you need the tax freezes, but you also need private developers and investment.
That's absolutely right. These are policy solutions, and it takes progressive public policy in order to make sure that our cities continue to work for everyone.
How are you feeling about public policy in this country today?
I'm feeling great about the leadership of our cities, where these issues really are at the fore. As you said earlier, Kai, it's our mayors who are worrying about creating jobs, making cities work, and making them work for everybody. And I have the great opportunity to meet with a number of mayors across the country. They're hardworking men and women. I think they're working really hard to get it right.
So when you think about economic progress coming out of historic preservation, is all progress the same progress? I mean, is economic development, or do you want it to be small business? Do you want it to be locals, or do you just want the dollars?
What we see over time is that historic buildings are great incubators for small business, for women and minority-owned businesses. They play a really important role in our cities and in our communities in providing that kind of flexible space that helps small business prosper. But at the end of the day, Kai, we want to see historic buildings in active use to their communities. We're not about casting things in amber and turning everything into a museum. We understand that historic buildings need to evolve over time and meet the needs of their community. And that may mean a small business, or it might mean a chain business. And in the end, our interest is in making sure that the building is in active service to the community and that the community is seeing these historic buildings as offering something very unique to their daily lives.
One of the things we haven't done very well in this country is be mindful of whose history we're preserving. Where does that fall on your checklist when you think about preserving X building or Y building?
Well, it's very important. when I took this job, one of the things that I learned early on is that a very small number of the formerly landmarked buildings in this country represent the history of women or people of color. Fewer than 10% is one statistic that I've heard. So our organization and preservation organizations generally have been very concerned in recent years about trying to level the playing field and ensuring that layers of American history, the full American story, is represented, especially in the formal designations, mm-hmm. places that receive formal designations. But more broadly, there are thousands of historic buildings in the country that may not have nationally significant history. They may not even have significant state or local history. They're just old, and they bring great charm and sort of an authenticity and a character to a place that makes your hometown different from my hometown. And those places are important to protect because they really improve the atmosphere. They create an environment that makes communities and neighborhoods the kind of places that we want to live.
That's a really important point. A lot of what you do for all the mapping and surveys and studies, a lot of this historical preservation thing is a subjective sense of history. I mean, yes, you've got the absolute, this is history, history, history. But then there's the building on the corner of 3rd and Main in Erie, Pennsylvania that means something to those folks.
Well, that's absolutely right. And when the National Trust was founded more than 60 years ago, part of our charter is to inspire the American people to engage in preservation. So there's a certain amount of work that we can do as the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But at the end of the day, we measure our success in how we can inspire others to look at the world around them, to look at their community and say, this place matters to me, and I'm going to work with my neighbors to protect it.
As you consider projects that get brought to you by towns and cities across the country for help with, how do the scales tip economic development versus historical preservation?
Well, this is we're looking actively at that intersection all the time. And I'll give you an example of a project that we're working on right now in the Little Havana neighborhood of Miami, which is an important neighborhood. It's been from a historical standpoint, it's been a landing point for immigrants to this country for a very long period of time, mm-hmm. and a gateway to prosperity for many Americans. It is now in the path of progress in Miami. Mm-hmm. And that part of Miami, that neighborhood, is at risk of losing a lot of the character and the affordability that make it a place that is home to immigrants who are still arriving in this country. So we're working actively with the city of Miami to think about how do you manage upzoning? How do you think about this intersection of economic development and historic preservation, ensuring that this neighborhood continues to serve the role that it has for the city and the country over time, while also meeting the needs of the community?
It's funny, there's a word for it, upzoning. It's a lingo.
Well, upzoning is thinking about how to increase density in a community, and we're for progress.
Right.
But we want to make sure that progress happens without destroying the character and the nature of the community that made it a special place to begin with.
What happens in a city or a town or anywhere if you don't get it right, if you preserve something that shouldn't have been preserved or that economic development doesn't happen?
Well, the thing about preservation is that if you're not successful, there's no going back. Something gets torn down, it's gone. And that's why we are, we advocate that demolition should always be the option of last resort. There are cities in Europe, for example, where you can see how buildings have just evolved over time. And that's a lesson that I think that American cities need to learn as well. How can we build on the infrastructure that we already have? These buildings are important economic incubators, but it's also important, Kai, from an environmental standpoint. We recycle cans and newspapers. We need to be thinking about how we recycle our buildings as well. It keeps a lot of stuff out of our landfills. It helps, you know, to diminish the amount of natural resources that we have to consume in order to build new buildings. Our historic buildings are helping, you know, create healthy cities, and they're helping create a healthy planet too.
Stephanie Meeks, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, so that's it for today's episode of Corner Office. Thanks for listening. Another one coming up for you in a couple of weeks. Don't forget to leave us that review, though, would you? This episode of Corner Office was produced by Bridget Bonder. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.